Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the mass protests that have erupted in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia over the past weeks. Pro-Western Georgians say free speech and democracy are at risk. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 15th of May, these are our main stories. Riot police confront protesters in Georgia after Parliament passes a foreign influence law that opponents fear will be used to stifle dissent. The US tells Ukraine more weapons are on their way to the front line. Joe Biden accuses China of cheating, not competing, as he introduces a massive package of trade tariffs. Also in this podcast, Donald Trump's legal team has been questioning his former fixer Michael Cohen's credibility as a witness at the ex-president's hush money trial in New York. And
it's the most important film festival in the world.
I like when all stars, they come to one city.
The film world gathers in the south of France as the Cannes Film Festival gets underway. Let's begin this podcast in Georgia. Been clashes between riot police and thousands of protesters in the capital Tbilisi after Parliament voted through a controversial bill which will force civil society and media organisations to register if they receive foreign funding. Critics are likening the bill to legislation in neighbouring Russia used to stifle dissent and silence criticism of the Kremlin. Thousands of protesters in the capital Tbilisi chanted no to the Russian law. The government claims it's necessary to maintain Georgian sovereignty. Rayan Dimitri is in Tbilisi.
It's been a dramatic day here in Tbilisi. Protesters clashed with the police after more than 3 weeks of demonstrations. At its heart is a fight over Georgia's future, one that takes it to Europe or one that takes it back to Russia.
They marched in with a warning. Against the protesters who have been demonstrating outside Parliament for weeks. Protesters stood defiantly, refusing to move away. And then violence. All in the name of a contentious law which protesters fear will mark the end of Georgia's democracy.
You get a sense now. They're moving more intensely. And the protesters are beginning to boo. They're being pushed away from the square.
We will be in the EU. We will be in the EU. Freedom to the Georgia.
Georgian people are standing for their right to make a decision, which is to be against this law. We do not wish it. It is dragging us back into the same hole that we finally crawled out of.
A similar foreign agents law exists in Russia, used there to crack down on government's critics. Georgians worry the same thing might happen here.
They are liars. They are Putin's guys, you know. They are doing Russian work here.
Earlier, MPs from the governing party passed the law after a debate turned into a brawl. Authorities defended the bill, saying it would help protect Georgia from foreign interference. Critics suspect the government is trying to protect the interests of one man, Bidzina Ivanishvili, a billionaire who made his fortune in Russia. These mass protests have been driven by Georgia's youth, standing up to defend their national dream of a future in Europe.
It's past 1 a.m. here, but many of the protesters still remain out in the streets, earlier visiting European officials addressed the demonstrators, and they said that the government refused to meet them, but they expressed support to the Georgian youth who are standing there here and fighting for their European future.
Rain Dimitri in Tbilisi. And for all the background on what's happening in Georgia, listen to the latest edition of the Global Story podcast, which looks closely at the mass protests as well as the controversial law which sparked them. Just look for the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Next to Ukraine, you're not alone. That was the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken's message to Ukraine almost 4 weeks since the US Congress approved $60 billion of military aid against an increasingly intense Russian offensive, but only after months of delays. Speaking in Kyiv, Mr. Blinken assured President Volodymyr Zelensky that weapons are now on their way to the front line.
The American people's support for Ukraine has been consistent over the course of the war. It has never wavered. Americans understand that our support for Ukraine strengthens the security of the United States and our allies. They understand that if Putin achieves his goals here in Ukraine, he won't stop with Ukraine. He'll keep going. For when in history has an autocrat been satisfied with carving off just part or even all of a single country? When has that satisfied Vladimir Putin?
Well, those US weapons are certainly needed. Ukrainian forces are still struggling to cope with a major Russian incursion in the northeast around the city of Kharkiv. Our defense correspondent Jonathan Beale is embedded with Ukrainian forces there.
There was some resistance when Russian troops first crossed the border. Video posted by Ukrainian border guards shows them trying to stop their advance. But there's drone footage too of Russian troops simply walking across the border, unopposed. They've captured more than 50 square miles of Ukrainian territory in a matter of days. Even Ukraine's most senior commanders admit the situation is critical, difficult and tense. People living close to the fighting are still fleeing. Some say the Russians were advancing, with the sound of machine gun fire getting closer. Yana had already packed all her belongings, even before this latest Russian assault.
Yes, we were ready. Yes, we were ready because all the warnings were just clear that that could happen.
And do you think the Ukrainian army was ready?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that they were ready that Russians could come, but our line of defense is not ready.
This is the second time that Russian forces have entered Kharkiv region. They've already left several villages and towns in ruins, and they're doing the same again. Ukraine pushed the Russians back in an offensive in 2022, but this time they've been starved of ammunition. Ukraine's limited resources are stretched, and President Putin's forces are making advances across the entire front.
Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale with Ukrainian forces in Kharkiv. Lawyers for Donald Trump have been cross-examining his former fixer, Michael Cohen, at the ex-president's hush money trial in New York. Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to falsifying business records and denies having a sexual encounter with the adult film actor Stormy Daniels. Speaking to reporters as he left court, Mr. Trump gave his assessment of the day's proceedings.
Today we had a very good day in court. You see what's happening. And you'll have to report it because I can't talk about it too much. But I think it was a very, very good day.
Michael Cohen was giving evidence for a second day and faced tough questioning from Mr. Trump's defense lawyers who sought to undermine his testimony. Our correspondent at the trial in New York is John Studworth.
In terms of that attack on his integrity, the prosecution tried to get their retaliation in early. They had Mr. Cohen admit on the stand that he was indeed prone to having told lies, that he was himself convicted and disgraced in 2018, that he had fallen out with Mr. Trump. But they were very careful in doing all that to make it clear, in Mr. Cohen's own words, that when he was lying, when he was doing those things, when he was engaged engaged in criminal conduct. It was almost all at the behest and under the instructions of his boss.
So pretty dramatic in court. One thing that I spotted today was that Donald Trump seemed to have quite an entourage with him of some of his Republican allies. What's that all about?
Well, it's not the first time we've had political supporters of Mr. Trump turn up here at the court, but it was significant today because amongst the governors and the senators, there was also the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, of course a very senior political figure in America, basically here to support Donald Trump, but in doing so, making some pretty strident statements. He said, for example, that nobody should believe a word that Michael Cohen says on the stand. He called this a corrupt trial. He attacked the judge's daughter. All the things, of course, Andrew, that Donald Trump is prohibited himself from doing under the gag order. And, you know, looking at this, you can say, of course, that there are legitimate legal discussions, debates, as there always are at high-profile criminal trials over the merits of the case, the likelihood of its success, whether or not this case should be brought. But that is entirely different from the charge that this is a case that is brought, politically motivated, backed by the Biden administration. There is absolutely no evidence for that claim. And some people will say that having senior Republican figures, people who hold a constitutional position here, making that claim is dangerous. It undermines American democracy. And there is, of course, a certain irony in that they are doing it in support of a man who himself is accused of having tried to illegitimately disrupt a legitimate transfer of power back in 2021, undermining democracy himself.
And does it feel like a serious legal proceeding, or does it feel like a circus?
Well, there are two different trials taking place here, Andrew. The one inside the court, which is absolutely a serious legal proceedings, under proper evidential rules, under the careful watch of a trial judge, with a jury taking notes, and a lot at stake. Outside of the court, it is a different matter, and it is clear that Donald Trump is determined not only to fight this in court, but to fight it, as he always does, in the court of public opinion too. And, you know, that entourage we saw today, the presence of Mike Johnson, is all part of that bigger strategy.
John Sudworth with me from New York. When he was American president, Mr. Trump imposed steep tariffs on imports from China. Today, President Biden seems to be in agreement with his predecessor. He's not only keeping the tariffs from the Trump presidency, but bringing in far more. Mr. Biden accused China of unfairly pouring state subsidies into its industries, which make far too much and then flood international markets, driving US companies out of business. He announced the new tariffs at the White House.
That's why today I'm announcing new tariffs in key sectors of the economy that are going to ensure that our workers are not held back by unfair trade practices. 25% tariff on Chinese steel and aluminum products. A 100% tariff on electric vehicles made in China. People say, wow. We're also implementing a 25% tariff on electric vehicle batteries from China. I'm determined that the future of electric vehicles will be made in America.
Fubing Feng, the Executive Vice President and Secretary General of the Chinese Association of Automobile Manufacturers, said Mr. Biden wasn't just punishing China, but also American consumers.
The United States wants to impose tariffs on Chinese new energy vehicles, which is a typical example of trade protectionism, which can only do harm, hurting businesses and consumers on both sides.
I found out more from our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore.
We're talking about tariffs, hikes on $18 billion worth of imports from China. Some of these are existing and increased, but they're all focusing on the key industries that power the green transition. This has been a real cornerstone for the Biden administration, even going back as far as the Inflation Reduction Act, these clean energy sectors looking to invest in them and to grow those sectors and those jobs in America. So we're looking at a 100% tariff on Chinese-made EVs that are imported into the U.S., up from 25%, a doubling of the tariff on solar cells to 50%, and a doubling of the tariff on semiconductors to 50%. We hear about semiconductors all the time. They're one of the hottest ticket items in tech today. So President Biden's administration says that these are designed to protect U.S. manufacturers from being undercut by China. He went to the podium today at the White House talking about how important this is for protecting American jobs. And there's a real business, global, and also political imperative here.
Now, China have come up with a sort of slightly cross-sounding response today. What can they actually do?
So we are looking to see if there will be a response, and there is likely to be one. But when you flesh this out step by step, you know, you start to ask whether we could start to see a tit-for-tat escalation. And remember, this has been going on for a long time. We all remember the President Trump era steel and aluminum tariffs. And in fact, this Biden administration plan was born out of a review of those tariffs. So out of the $18 billion of imports, it strikes me that there's less than 5%. The ones targeted, I mean, are less than 5% of our total imports from China. And so the numbers themselves are a bit smaller than you might anticipate, especially from how big this announcement has been from the White House. That, I expect, to be an important factor in how China responds.
The context, I think, is so interesting. Everything through the prism of the election coming up in November. Mm. We're going to get many months now of Trump and Biden tearing lumps out of each other and saying they hate each other. On this, they literally agree about every detail, don't they?
Close, yeah. And in fact, you know, this is something that President Trump came out and said. He was talking about a 60% or higher tariff across the board on imports from China. You know, when you look at the polling, and I often dig into this from the Pew Research Center and others, you can see that being tough on Beijing is broadly popular among Democrats and Republicans. And we can't say that about a lot of things in American culture today. So I think both presidents know that this could do something, especially in swing states, to pump up their numbers come the election.
Erin Delmore with me. A new study has found that the summer of 2023 was the warmest in the Northern Hemisphere in 2,000 years. Researchers in Britain and Germany say temperatures last June, July and August were nearly 4 degrees Celsius warmer than the coolest summer in that period. They say global warming combined with the El Niño climate pattern made last year an exceptional event. Here's our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
One of the big challenges for climate scientists is trying to understand just how hot current temperatures are compared with the historical record. Reliable global data from thermometers exists only from around 1850. Going back further requires the use of indirect temperature measures such as tree rings, which record information about the state of the climate for each year that they grow. This study used ones that grew at high altitudes, such as the European Alps and the Russian Altai Mountains. Professor Alf Bunchen from the University of Cambridge is one of the study's co-authors. He explained why the location of the trees was important.
These are sites where tree growth is predominantly controlled by summer temperature. So small changes in a warmer or a cooler summer at these extreme sites are reflected in the different tree ring parameters. So how wide is the ring? How narrow is the ring?
Having built an accurate annual picture of past summer temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere, the researchers were able to show that several years were cooled by sulfur and aerosols emitted from large-scale volcanic eruptions. The summer of the year 536 was almost 4 degrees cooler than 2023. The main takeaway is that last June, July and August were more than 2 degrees warmer than the average over almost two millennia. This is due to climate change driven by humans, with some help from the El Niño weather phenomenon. The researchers hope that this greater clarity over climate past will prompt political leaders to do much more about climate present.
Matt McGrath reporting. And still to come in this podcast.
But I think in complexities of life, you can hardly apply the words optimistic or pessimistic or happy or unhappy to them. They just seem to me terribly interesting.
Alice Munro, the first Canadian to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, has died at the age of 92.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the mass protests that have erupted in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia over the past weeks. Pro-Western Georgians say free speech and democracy are at risk. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The Hollywood actor Meryl Streep has been awarded an honorary Palme d'Or at the opening ceremony of this year's Cannes Film Festival. Presenting the prize, the French star Juliette Binoche told Ms. Streep she changed the way we look at women. This year's film festival is being held against a backdrop of a Me Too reckoning in France. Some of the country's biggest film stars have published an open letter calling for a new law to crack down on systemic sexism and gender-based violence. From Cannes, here's Tom Brooke.
The French Riviera has been abuzz as the world's biggest and arguably most prestigious film festival gets underway. Outside the Palais des Festivals in Cannes, where films are shown, tourists and movie fans gather.
It's the most important film festival in the world.
I like when all stars, they come to one city.
But there's been uncertainty in the air at Cannes this year with a threatened strike by behind-the-scenes workers, including projectionists and ticket sellers. And there's also massive chatter about a possible Me Too protest, in which a French website may reveal the names of significant figures in the French film industry and their alleged predatory transgressions. The festival is trying to keep the focus on movies. One of the more eagerly awaited films in competition this year is Megalopolis from legendary 85-year-old US director Francis Ford Coppola. It's a sci-fi drama set in a city that resembles New York, with Adam Driver playing an architect who believes he can stop time.
Time stop!
During the 12-day festival, Cannes exists as a world apart, a film lover's paradise packed with screenings and glitzy events. But the harsh realities of the outside world won't be kept at bay this year, because they'll be evident in several festival films. An air raid siren in Kyiv can be heard in a funeral scene in the haunting Cannes documentary called The Invasion. It comes from one of Ukraine's foremost filmmakers, Sergei Loznitsa. It's a mammoth work involving a series of carefully composed extended sequences showing life in Ukraine since the invasion. And the Israel-Gaza conflict will no doubt colour how festivalgoers perceive the Cannes film The Bell from Gaza, a documentary in which transgender women, several from Palestinian families, are seen on the streets of Tel Aviv discussing their lives. And while former President Donald Trump sits in a New York courtroom 4,000 miles from Cannes, one of the big attractions at the festival will be The Apprentice, a film portraying him in his younger years as a rising force in the New York real estate world. Cannes has a knack for recognising great cinema. Last year, the French legal drama Anatomy of a Fall and the British-Polish Holocaust-era picture The Zone of Interest were both launched at Cannes, where they were given prizes. They went on to win critical acclaim around the world and Academy Awards. So, what we may be witnessing here in Cannes in the next few days is the emergence of early contenders in next year's Oscars race.
In northern France, two prison officers have been killed as an inmate was freed by a heavily armed gang as he was being transported back to jail. The man who was freed, Mohamed Amra, is believed to have links to a criminal gang. A huge search involving hundreds of police officers is still underway. The French Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, says the group will be brought to justice.
Tout sera mis en œuvre.
Everything will be done to find the perpetrators of this despicable crime. We will spare no effort, no means. We will track them down. We will find them and they will pay. We owe it to the victims. We owe it to their families and loved ones. We owe it to all members of the prison administration. We owe it to all French people.
Our correspondent Hugh Schofield is following developments and spoke to my colleague Sean Lay.
This has shocked the nation. The government has determined that every resource shall be thrown at the tracking down of these men. And it means, I think, that there are, well, you know, hundreds of officers out there, gendarmes and police in the area and beyond now. And there'll be some on the ground, but many others, I'm sure, poring over the various bits of intelligence which are going to be coming in and from the analysis of the scene and so on. You know, one suspects that eventually they'll be cornered, but who knows where. They had a good advance and they zoomed away in cars. The vehicles were left behind, so they're in other cars which won't be necessarily known to the police. It's a big operation because the country and the government are particularly appalled by the savagery of the attack and the wanton violence and the willingness to take lives which accompanied it.
You were at the scene. Are there signs of just how violent this was?
Clearly, the police are there, and I've been poring over the detail and the forensic detail that they can get from the scene. I couldn't see enough because we were kept well back to see traces of blood or anything like that. But it was all had it all been cleared up. But
bullets were clearly fired because of these fatalities. What do we know about the prisoner who has escaped? The man who was being freed.
There's an awful lot being speculated about him. One of the things that's being said is, why such an enormous professional criminal job to rescue a man who, by all accounts, or to all appearances, was only a kind of medium-sized fish in the criminal pond. Clearly, he had dealings, he had a long criminal record, but it was sort of middle-ranking things like theft, mainly. He was involved, possibly, in a murder down in Marseille, but that he hasn't been convicted of that. The speculation is that he was rather bigger fish than people maybe realise, or maybe that the authorities realised, and that from his cell, because he's been in jail a lot, and was in jail, he'd been operating systems and networks from his cell.
Our correspondent, Hugh Schofield. Elections to the European Parliament now just a few weeks away, with immigration, the economy and environmental measures topping the agenda. Abortion rights campaigners say women's health issues aren't getting sufficient attention. Our Europe correspondent Jessica Parker has this report from the German city of Hamburg.
Adriana Behran volunteers to help improve abortion access after having one herself 5 years ago. She and a fellow campaigner are talking about information leaflets. In Germany, abortions are, in reality, permitted during early pregnancy, but remain technically illegal.
When I read the penalty law, it really crushed me, because it really says you're still a criminal when you decide to have an abortion. You can do it up until 12 weeks without being actually punished, but you're still kind of a criminal. And also the law is written like that they're trying to force you to think about it and to keep the pregnancy. So they're really pushing you into one direction.
Do you think this issue, women's health issues, have a prominent enough place in public debate?
Well, of course not. Women's issues are most of the time not like the main priority. I really prefer if we had like an EU law that ensures that everyone has access to safe abortion.
In central Hamburg, people relax in the sun sipping coffees. Even in wealthy liberal cities like this, campaigners say women face barriers to abortion, while access across Europe can significantly vary. From France, where abortions have become a constitutional right, to almost total illegality in Poland and Malta.
Abortion laws are set by member states, but a majority of EU lawmakers in the last parliament called for access to be guaranteed across the bloc. It's a prime example of how some, often more in the centre or left of politics, see the EU as an engine for social change, while others, often more to the right, believe Brussels is already too interfering.
They're overstepping their competences because that's not really their business.
In a Hamburg park, I meet Cornelia Kaminski. She leads a group called Action Right to Life for All that campaigns against abortion. While the EU Parliament's vote was largely symbolic, she warns against EU overreach.
It's up to the nations to say whether they want to have this or that particular abortion law. And the EU shouldn't meddle with that. They've done that with other things. They try to interfere with nations' sovereignty. And I think they shouldn't push the nations too far. We've seen what happens if they do that. And when people pick up on those ideas in particular countries, you saw that in the UK, and they play it well, then people might turn away on a larger scale from the European Union. And that's not a good idea.
And a law professor at Hamburg University, Marian Albers, believes any EU-wide change is a distant prospect.
I think member states focus very much on having competencies in criminal law, and especially in these sensitive areas of abortion.
I'm standing on a street in western Hamburg, and look, you can certainly tell that EU elections are just round the corner. There are campaign placards up all over the place. And if, as some polls predict, there's a rightward shift in this election, that could diminish calls for embedding abortion rights as parties push starkly different visions of how far the EU should reach into people's lives.
Jessica Parker reporting. Flooding in southern Brazil has continued to worsen after three more days of heavy rain. 148 people are known to have died across Rio Grande do Sul state. Here's Leonardo Rocha.
After the heavy rain of the previous 2 weeks stopped on Friday, some of the 600,000 people who had been forced to leave their homes returned to clean up. But the lull didn't last. Fresh storms hit the hills outside the state capital, Porto Alegre, causing new landslides and flooding. Water levels on the Guaíba River, which passes through the city, have been rising again. They're now expected to reach a new record high. Many areas of Porto Alegre, a city of 1.4 million people, remain underwater and without power. This is the worst natural disaster in the history of Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil's southernmost state.
Canada's first ever winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Alice Munro, has died at the age of 92. She got the award in 2013 for her ability to master the notoriously difficult art of the short story, which she only started writing because she felt she had neither the time nor the talent to perfect novels. Vincent Dowd looks back at her career. Alice Munro was born in the small town of Wingham, Ontario, and she spent much of her life in Ontario, which supplied the characters she wrote about with insight. Her subjects, ambition and failure, and the comedy of human existence rang true with readers well beyond her own country. Her books of stories led some to call her Canada's Chekhov. The first collection came in 1968. 5 years before that, she and her first husband had opened a bookstore in British Columbia called Munro's Books. As a writer, more than a dozen collections of fiction followed. And in 2009, she was awarded the Man Booker International Prize. 4 years later came a bigger award.
Nobelpriset i litteratur år 2013 tilldelas den kanadensiska författaren Alice Munro.
The Nobel citation described her simply as a master of the short story. Alice Munro once said in an interview that as she grew older, her view of life became less gloomy.
I think it's terribly easy when you're young to be very tragic about everything, perhaps very pessimistic, and to feel that this really marks your maturity. That's been leaving me in the last few books. I think some fairly happy things happen. I think the thing is now, you know, that I think in complexities of life, you can hardly apply the words optimistic or pessimistic or happy or unhappy to them. They just seem to me terribly interesting.
Alice Munro said the starting point of a story was normally a small incident in real life. She said she'd found the first 20 years of her life difficult. What came later had been much easier. Vincent Dowd reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. It's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X. We are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randell. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
I was drawn to the mountains even as a little girl, simply out of a passion and a desire to move around in nature.
Five mountaineers with the same personal goal. To be the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest peaks.
I wanted to push myself to the limit.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their inspiring story.
You find something inside you to continue.
Our own strength. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.